Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area here in central Iowa. Susan Franzen, you're our host for today for a most unusual program. Just what is that?
What makes this special is that it is dedicated of welcome and hospitality that Joanna Courteau embodied in the 47 years that she lived in Ames. She died a month ago on July 5th. Our first guests will be two of her students in Spanish who were also among her study abroad classes. Then my co-host, Roberta Van, will guide us through the many groups Joanna fostered in Ames. But let's start with Gary Stahl. Hello, Gary. Would you please introduce yourself and tell us why you said would not be where you were today if it weren't for Joanna?
Sure. My name is Gary Stahl. I am currently the director of private sector fundraising and partnerships for UNICEF based in our Geneva headquarters. The short version of the story is I was a pre-vet. Anna found me wandering the hallways one day and asked me if I wanted to talk. And she talked to me about all the options open to me. And I'm the first one in my family to go to college. So I didn't realize all the options that were open to me. And she became then my advisor. And I took a Spanish and a Portuguese class with her when I had a terrible accident. I was working at a meatpacking plant in the wee hours of the morning to put myself through college. And I couldn't walk for 9 months. And the only building I could get to was the languages building. So I ended up, since she was helping me anyway, even though I had nothing to do with her area, I thought, well, I'll take a Spanish and a Portuguese class. And I mean, the rest is pretty much history. I ended up being a translator, then I was a conference interpreter for years. And then I've spent most of my life in Latin America, more in Spanish speaking than in Portuguese speaking. But I think Teresa and I both started off in Spanish and kind of ended up in Portuguese. My job just before this was UNICEF representative to the government of Brazil for 5.5 years. But it's just her spirit of seeing an obviously lost student. I mean, lost not physically, but lost mentally, and saying, can I help you? And I said, oh, but I'm not a language student. And, well, it doesn't matter. I can be your advisor. It doesn't matter. And she just explained so many things and invited me into her home and of her friends, and I became a Latin Americanist. I mean, I graduated with a double major, one in Spanish literature and one in international studies, with a minor in Portuguese and a minor in zoology. But really, she was the key person, and we've been in touch all this time. I had children 11 years ago, and she's been in touch with them, and they speak in Portuguese on the phone. In fact, they talked just before she went into the hospital. I was talking to her daughter, Jackie, who said she was so happy with the conversation and so impressed with her. So she's been a lifelong mentor and friend. What can I say?
Thank you. And so my question, where are you now? I guess you've answered.
I am. I went into the Peace Corps after college. And then I went back to do a master's in philology and linguistics at UT Austin, which I never actually finished. And it was Joanna who got me in there at the semester. I had a medical issue. I had to leave the Peace Corps quickly. She got me in almost overnight because of her contacts. I left because I realized that isn't what I really wanted to study, but I still didn't know what I wanted to do. So I moved to Latin America, started three businesses, and I did actually quite well. But one of them, which didn't make that much money, but which I loved, was being an interpreter. And I was freelance. I did a lot for the Ecuadorian government because I was based in Quito. And I did a lot for some UN agencies in Europe and US and in Latin, all over Latin America. And that led me to the conferences of UNICEF in the late 80s, when UNICEF was trying to debate whether they should throw their weight behind the Convention on the Rights of the Child and become a child rights organization, or if they should continue to be a needs-based organization. Because until that point, it had been Save the Children that had been pushing child rights as an international treaty of law. So I was so impressed with the quality of the dialogue of UNICEF staff and the old-timers we're all saying, oh, what is this rights business? And no, we will never have enough money to take care of every child. And the sort of younger generation of leadership was explaining, it's not about us doing everything, but it's about us working at the policy level, talking to governments about making sure every policy includes all children, no matter what their condition, no matter where they live, making sure there's enough fiscal space for all of the social programming. It's a different way of looking at things instead of just going in and running vaccination programs instead of the government. And I said to myself at the time, you know, I've learned a lot being an interpreter for 6 years, but if this goes through, I'm going to work for UNICEF. Well, it wasn't quite so easy to work for UNICEF, so I had to go back and do a real master's. And I did that in economic development at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And then I started in the genocide in Rwanda, and you know, here I am today, director here, and thinking of retiring from the UN and going to do something more local in the US, because I was a single father until a couple months ago when I got married. And my daughters really want some sort of connection to the US because they know they were born there from a surrogate mother, but they don't know anything else. And so we're going to be moving back to do something. But I'm talking too much about myself. I mean, Joanna, what I saw her do to the lives of so many other people was just phenomenal. And she was so ecumenical in her outreach and she invited me to these Polish celebrations with eggs and flavored vodka in the spring. I had nothing to do with the Polish community, if you know what I mean. She had her friends from the local Unitarian church. Her house was always open. There was always a place to crash. And as you said earlier, there was generally always somebody crashing there, whether it was for a night or a week or a month or 2 months. I'm now in touch since her death with a couple of people who reached out to me, who tell me that, you know, how they stayed in her house or in her basement for I don't know how long to get their feet on the ground. She helped me because one of my jobs there was working in fair housing, and I helped a lot of international students find housing. And she just, I mean, such an amazing spirit, such generosity, such ability to share. I've never really come across anyone quite like that. I don't know. She was such an amazing woman, and the fact that she's accompanied me throughout my whole career, and I've accompanied her career and her later, you know, and then she was doing these things online. I mean, always busy and intellectually very busy. I'm sure Teresa probably knows more about what she did in terms of her research and that. But I remember her research on Fernando Pessoa, who, you know, in my early Portuguese days, I didn't really understand, but I've really come to appreciate that as my Portuguese has gotten so much better over the years, using it professionally and whatnot. I think of her all the time. I remember my initial meetings when I walked into Brazil and I went to meet the ministers. Almost every single minister in the cabinet after meeting me said, oh my God, but since when does a gringo show up in Brazil speaking beautiful Portuguese? I mean, how did this happen? Because they're used, you know, the senior UN staff are always from somewhere else. You can't be from the country you work in because you have diplomatic status. And they're not used to anyone who actually speaks proper Portuguese. And I would smile and I'd say, actually, I learned from an amazing woman in Iowa. And they would just look at me like, what? First of all, where is Iowa? Secondly, why do they teach Portuguese there? But I think she would bend over backwards to help people who really wanted to learn in any of her classes and answer all of our questions. She was just amazing.
Oh, thank you, Gary. That couldn't have been a better introduction to the morning. But in case you just tuned in, you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. This is a tribute to Joanna Corto from one of her students, Gary Stahl, whose life's work has been international, as you heard. The second student we contacted, Teresa Scatterfield, turned out to be like an adopted member of Joanna's family. And it all started on a trip to Spain. Was that the same trip that Gary was on, Teresa?
Good morning, Susan and everyone. Yeah, and congratulations, Gary, on your wedding. what a life that you're living is amazing. So that's exactly where I met Gary, and we were part of Joanna's gang. And it's so interesting because, yeah, I had to travel halfway around the world to meet Gary. We didn't seem to coincide in classes with Joanna. I'm not sure if I was a couple years ahead or he was, but maybe because of his zoology connections, we didn't meet. But I was also actually double majoring. And I think that was one of the gifts that Joanna helped me see, that you can have it all, right? You don't have to just be satisfied with having one compartment of your life. You can kind of spread your wings and do many things that interest you and that you love. And so in Spain, Joanna was my professor for some classes, and she was teaching literature, but I actually turned out to be a formal linguist, so computational linguist doing computer modeling. And I think there was a part of that. It also connects with Charlie, Joanna's husband, who is an economist. And we actually talked a lot about math and science, and my work ended up being, as I said, in formal linguistics, where I studied language acquisition. And part of that actually has to be related to Joanna's work. Although, as I said, she did a lot with literature, she always had an interest in linguistics, and she was multilingual. And I also ended up studying the Romance languages, Italian, French, Portuguese, and my main language of Spanish. But in Spain, Joanna was as at home as she is and was in any place in the world. And so I think I mentioned how we lived with this widowed woman, Doña Candida. And Joanna did not back down from having heated discussions with her about politics and government and human rights in Spain. And so I got a very good education in terms of just being in a different country and seeing how you can navigate those waters. And so we're on Zoom here, so you can see I'm a person of color in 1980s Spain, right after Franco. Spain was still pretty much closed, and so a lot of people had not experienced people of African descent. And so daily I would run to Joanna about racism I was experiencing, or not even racism, just people being curious and touching my skin and my hair when I'm walking through the streets in Spain. And so she really helped me to kind of get through that time and understand myself and other people in the world. And she was always generous and kind. And even though I might say something negative about people being racist, she would say, well, you're in a good position to help teach them, right? So this is a good experience for them. And you can give them, you know, something that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And I think that was one of the best pieces of advice that I've used throughout the rest of my career. And so I've also been a nomad, not to the extent that Gary has, but I've gotten to live in Latin America. My husband actually grew up in Brazil, no Rio. And so we have also that Portuguese connection. We have two teenagers now who speak fluent Spanish. Their Portuguese is okay, but they grew up from day one knowing Joanna because she relocated to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I'm a professor in linguistics. Joanna was at every event with our family. We were at events with her family because her daughter, Jacqueline, does live in Ann Arbor with and her two children who are now in college and older. So our families blended so well. And so any holiday picture, Joanna will be in that picture with my family. My kids spoke to her only in Spanish, and she was like their grandmother. So we are devastated by this loss, not just me and in terms of my intellectual birth. And she was definitely a part of that. We talked a lot about research till the end, right? So I remember in February, she was at a stay in the hospital in Ann Arbor, and I was going to her house daily to walk her dog, Bella, that maybe some of you have met. And even in those days, she was making me hot soup, vichyssoise, which I loved her recipe. And we would sit at her kitchen table in the evenings and talk about the research that I was doing and how it was connecting to events in the world. And I'll say one more thing that Gary made me think of that definitely Joanna put the seed into my mind. I'm the director of a Spanish language school here in Ann Arbor for heritage language speakers. Now, these are children who speak Spanish in the home, and they don't have a bilingual school or education program here in Michigan. And so we put together a program, an academic program for families, and a large portion of those are migrant families and families who have low resources. And so we have a free school that helps these children learn Spanish on an academic level and maintain their Spanish. And Joanna visited our program many times, made connections with the families and the kids. And that is, for the last 10 years, my passion and something that motivates me. And as I said, Joanna was very much instrumental in bringing that together.
Thank you. One of the wonderful things about putting together this program is how much I've learned about Joanna. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and our tribute to Joanna Courteau has concentrated on her students. We have just heard from two of Joanna's students, Gary Stahl, and Teresa Satterfield. In a university town, many teachers change students' lives and sometimes become parts of their families. What made Duana unusual was her spontaneous generosity that came from being a stranger in a strange land. She instinctively reached out to newcomers, especially from other countries. The co-host for the second half of the show has experienced this. Roberta Van, thanks for being with us to tell us ways that Joanna brought the world to Ames.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here. I met Joanna when I was a brand new professor here at Iowa State. I was 30 years old. I didn't know a soul in town. And after I'd been here for a few weeks, the phone rang. And it was, of course, Joanna. Somehow, I didn't know this person, but she had discovered that I had lived in Poland while I did a Fulbright there a few years earlier. And so she, as a Polish speaker and a native of Poland, she said, well, we have this Polish club in Ames, and maybe you'd like to come. You know, you could come over and meet some of the people. And well, it turned out it was more than just a Polish club. I mean, when you went to Joanna's, you met Brazilians, Americans, Spanish speakers, people from all over the world. You met rich people, poor people, famous people, humble people. And so that was always the way it was at Joanna's. But Joanna and I became good friends. I, like Gary and Teresa, I was always impressed with her incredible generosity towards me, but also towards everyone she met. And also her sense of optimism and hope, even in the grimmest of times. I went through an illness that she coached me through and gave me a lot of hope. And I also worked with her a lot as a fellow professor at the university. As Teresa mentioned, Joanna had an interest in linguistics, and I was in the applied linguistics section of the English department. And so Joanna served on many thesis and dissertation committees with me. And as Teresa mentioned, and Gary, she was incredibly supportive of students. She never had an unkind word. She was incredibly supportive of whatever they did. We had stronger students, weaker students. It didn't matter. Joanna was encouraging and helped people perform at their highest level. But back to the Polish club, I met many people in the Polish club who became lifelong friends, actually. And some of them were not Polish, but some of them were. And one of them was Micah. And I think we have Micah here today. Micah, can you talk a little bit too about the Polish club?
My husband and our two kids in Iowa as fresh immigrants off the boat in 1985. It was summer of 1985. And somebody told me there's a Polish godmother in this town. And I don't remember how I met her, but I remember that on the day I met her, she became my dear lifelong friend. To me, she was never Joanna. She was always Jasia, which is an endearing term for her first name. We always spoke Polish when nobody was around. So she was really like true my Polish friend. And she helped me navigate through the politics of the United States. There were so many things that I didn't understand. At that time, when we arrived to the United States, Reagan was kind of a hero to Polish people, because he was one of those presidents that was standing behind the Polish people resisting the communists. So we thought he was a good guy. And so Joanna made sure that I understood that there was not so much goodness in Reagan. So we had lots of discussions regarding politics. She was so busy. She was so busy, like you would invite her for dinner at 6. She would come late because she was coming from another party. She would leave before dessert because she was going yet to another party. She was always on the run. always on the run, but also doing good things on the run, like, you know, taking participating in many committees and many social events. And many times she would kind of force me to be a little bit more active. And there was something about Joanna, you just couldn't say no to her. I would say no in Polish and yeah, and I didn't have time, and this is something I cannot do right now. Somehow she would find ways for me to do those things against my will, and I never minded, because it took me to many interesting places. And one of my fondest memories is all these parties, and I probably met Gary. I may not remember Gary, I may not remember Teresa, but there were like thousands of people coming in and leaving. It's just not possible to remember all these wonderful people at her house. You know, at that time, there were quite many Polish scientists coming to America, mostly, you know, postdoc positions. So there were quite a big bunch of Polish people attending to those parties. And they didn't understand, they couldn't understand how anybody, just, you know, being a professor, living on a professor's salary, could throw all these parties. So they actually came up with a conclusion that it must have been funded by the university, that she is kind of like the ambassador for all foreigners coming to Ames, because not everybody was associated with Iowa State. And so they are funding her, you know, to welcome all these foreigners. Of course, it was not true. She would welcome anybody. And I know that one of her good friends, he was a young man that was stranded in Des Moines at airport, and there was a snowstorm, and he had no way to get to Ames. You know, of course, she took him not only to Ames, but she brought him to her house, and he was a house guest for many, many months before he was able to find a place for himself. And so this is what I remember about Joanna, you know, always non-critical, you know, non-judgmental. If I would vent frustration, she would kind of take a different twist, you know, she would say, Mario, but you think, you know, think about this aspect. And she would always pull me, you know, to a better place. And her Polish, you know, her command of Polish was really, really good. When she told me that she learned Polish as an adult, supposedly a Polish doctor living in Ames at the time, Lila, I don't know, some may you remember her, she was the director of medical center at Iowa State. But there were some mysterious aspects about Joanna she didn't want to reveal about the whole truth about her. But to me, you know, her Polish was too good, you know, to be, you know, I learned English as a child, but, you know, a school system, and then came to the States, and I will die with my accent, and I sometimes, you know, mix grammar, and I think my English is not that bad. So, but her Polish was not only very good, she knew the songs, I never was able to know all the lyrics. She knew the poems in Polish. She was like the best Polish person ever. She really knew the literature. She was always following what's going on in Poland. So we had many, many discussions, and maybe in some cases I helped her understand what's going on in Poland. And you know, going back to Easter, so she had this always, she and Charlie, her husband, had big gatherings. Especially for Easter, and one of the traditions that she supposedly brought from Poland was eating a hard-boiled egg with vodka. And we have never seen anything like this. You know, Poles drink vodka, but not with eggs. So we tried to tell her, you know, Joanna, this is not a Polish tradition. You know, like, you know, you don't start your Easter with vodka and eggs. But that's what she saw someplace, and that's what she tried to kind of the culture she was trying to bring to Ames, you know, drinking vodka with hard-boiled eggs. So she also organized many picnics, and I was kind of her, you know, commander-in-chief, you know, if she had a little bit of time between one event and another political party, she would call and say, Maya, there's a time to get all the Polish people for a picnic. But like Gary said, you know, she kind of like had a very instinct for lost people, you know, many people, you know, like regardless if they came from Poland or France, whatever, when you come to a foreign country, you don't know the culture that well, you don't know the language that well, and definitely you don't know anybody. So she always made sure that all her Polish friends not only had a place to be together, but also she would always invite American friends, because she thought that it's very important for Polish people not only to meet each other and have and spend some time with each other, but also to meet the locals and make friends with the local people. So those picnics, you know, in summer, that was another thing that she organized. And I think there was a big piece of her heart that belonged to Poland. I believe that her other part belonged to Brazil, but my understanding is that a bigger chunk belonged to Poland.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting how, Mike, she brought people together, because I remember one time at Joanna's house, you and I were talking, and you asked me where I had lived when I was in Poland, and I said, well, actually, I lived in Gdynia, and you said, Gdynia? My gosh, I lived in Gdynia. And then you asked me what street I lived on, and we had lived about a block apart, and we were there at the same time in the 70s, and we never met. But of course, we met at Joanna's. And so we keep hearing this theme of how Joanna brought people together from all parts of the world. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. And I'm sure I was thinking about the parties. And one of the parties that I remember very vividly with you, every year we would have the currant picking party. Remember that?
Festival.
The currant festival. Yeah. That's right. And Joanna would call and say, the currants are ripe. The currants are ripe. And most of us, especially our spouses, would moan and say, oh dear, mosquitoes, humidity, heat, you know.
And little currants.
Yeah, and tiny little currants. And but we always took home a little bag of currants at the end of the party. We cooked sausages on the grill with Charlie and had a wonderful time fighting off mosquitoes and so forth. And Joanna taught me a little trick. You know, she said, I said, well, what do you do with currants? You know, I don't know what to do with currants. And she said, always add a little bit of currants, just a tablespoon or so of the bitter currants to any cobbler, and it will give it sort of a nuance, sort of an edge. And so Joanna, we haven't mentioned this, but she was a fabulous cook, and she gave me many hints over the years. And I'm sure you remember too, Micah, her standing, and probably you, Gary, and Teresa too, standing at the stove. She'd have two or three pots she'd be stirring at the same time. And she'd also be carrying on three conversations, one in English, one in Portuguese, and one in Polish or Spanish, simultaneously flipping back and forth. So she had a kind of sink or mesh mind that I always admired. You know, she could just go from one topic to another with the greatest of ease.
Yeah, and I would also add that many people after leaving Ames, you know, they never took Joanna and her parties for granted, but they would say, and including us, we have never experienced anything like that. You know, going to this, you know, like 1,000 people party from all over the world, kind of like UNICEF, you know, and
right.
at her house, and meeting all these wonderful, wonderful people, you know, like just extraordinary experience. Mm-hmm. And that's one of Roberta. I met Roberta, of course, and then I found out that she was living in my hometown.
And I'm sure we met Gary and Teresa too at some point. Yeah. But there was a cast of thousands often at Joanna's house.
And I have to say, you look very familiar. I know, and so I'm sure we have met.
And for my part, I totally believed that boiled eggs go very well with vodka. So being non-Polish, it made perfect sense to me.
Yeah, Joanna made her own customs, and we all followed along. And one of her other customs was telling a story at the end of a party often. We had Valentine's Day parties there, and she used to, at the end of the party, she always insisted that we each tell a story. And each year there was a theme. And so usually it was something like, well, how did you two meet? Or something like that, you know, and she would go around and we would each have to tell a story. You probably remember that, Micah.
Yeah, that was another, you know, this was maybe a little bit more selective because it was a Valentine's party and Joanna and Charlie insisted that it had to be only 14 people, so only 7 couples. And so we would start with it. The dinner was, let's say, at 7. It all started like by 9, some people, older people were falling asleep and, you know, the food was coming and I'm coming. There was always a very good excellent food. She herself didn't drink wine, but there was always a great selection of wine. Right. And she would always get the best bread and the best cheeses.
Right.
One thing, though, that no one has mentioned, these huge parties, she didn't cook all the food. She had potlucks. And for the Valentine's parties in particular, I remember, she said, you bring the salmon, you bring the dessert. And for some reason, Charlie had once eaten my Caesar salad, which was made with a raw egg. You really shouldn't eat a raw egg unless it's cooked. I mean, that doesn't make sense. You shouldn't eat raw eggs because it might be dangerous. But I think that's what he thought. This salad is a little bit dangerous. And so I always got to bring the Caesar salad. And the people who had to bring the salmon or the dessert looked enviously at my easy salad. But one thing that we haven't mentioned because of the people I could find were the Brazilians, because she had, I met a few Brazilians at her other parties, but she was part of the Brazilian group in a very different way. She welcomed Brazilians, I think probably as soon as they got to Ames, and many of them live there. And I spoke most recently to Raquel, who lived there for 6 months. And she told me, yes, she met her fiance in Ames because of the Brazilian students there. And that they're going to be married soon. And Joanna said, I have my dress picked out. So, and I know Joanna would have been very happy that Raquel met her future husband, Joanna's.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, thanks to all of you. Now, we need to spend a little time on the many organizations besides the Polish Club. Roberta, can you help me? Were you at any of the receptions you did for the Institute on World Affairs?
Yeah, Joanna was an active member of the Institute of World Affairs, and they used to organize lectures of very famous people to come to these lectures. And one of the lectures was General Westmoreland. And so nobody on the committee apparently wanted to have Westmoreland over. You know, it was kind of intimidating, and maybe there was some political problem, I don't know. But anyway, Joanna, of course, eagerly volunteered to host Westmoreland. And I wasn't at the party, but I heard about it. And the interesting thing is that Joanna had this huge leak in her dining room, and it must have been at least a yard across. And so I said to her, I said, Joanna, you hosted Westmoreland with this, you know, the rain pouring in. And Joanna had no problem with that at all. You know, she decorated this hole in the wall with crepe paper. And some of you may remember the crepe paper hanging down from this leaky ceiling. So that Joanna had a real active role, I know, on the Institute of World Affairs, which fit perfectly with her personality, you know, the interest in politics and internationalism and hosting people. So perfect fit for Joanna, that particular university activity.
Yes. Well, one of the amazing things, we've talked about these big parties. She didn't live in a very big house.
Right.
But she often had 100 or 200 people there. And I think one of you, either Micah or Roberta, explained that, you know, they would sort of come through in waves. So they weren't all there at one time, perhaps because they couldn't all fit in anymore. And I remember a Polish Easter when was expected to go into the very large backyard with all the currant bushes, but it rained on Easter. And so we were, I think, it felt like 200 people crammed into the house. And I remember my husband Fritz and Bob Haug getting a tent, you know, like a, I suppose, a six-foot square tent, and putting it up on the deck outside of the dining room so that you people could get in there to stay out of the rain and figure out the house. And another thing, only once did I go to a Christmas party, Polish Christmas party. And surprisingly, except for the Jankowiaks and the Pruskis, I didn't know very many people there. But I recognized an Israeli woman that I had met because she had Pita Pita in Campustown. And I sat by her and I said, you know, why are you at a Polish Christmas party? And she said, I grew up in Poland and I miss the Polish food. And they had Polish food for a Polish Christmas party. And she felt at home.
Right. Yeah, that was typically Joanna, to include people in a very broad sense in these parties. I remember going to Brazilian parties occasionally, even though I had no connection with Brazil. But that didn't bother Joanna. You were always welcome.
One of the funny things is, and I think she brought this tradition from Brazil, it's coming out party for young people. So when Roberta's daughter and my son and Emil Bladel, they were all the same age. They just graduated from elementary school. And Joanna decided that it's time for them to kind of come out party, right? And remember, our kids were utterly embarrassed. You know, this is the age, you know, when they are 14 and they don't like to be around each other, and there was a boy and two girls, and she kind of forced them to reveal their talents. So I think maybe your daughter was playing piano. I don't know what my son did, but there was some kind of talent sharing, and it was the most embarrassing thing for our kids. I remember they were like so unhappy to be there. But today, you know, looking from the perspective, you know, my son thinks it was a good experience that he had gone through.
Right, right. Yeah, she was like a great aunt, I think, to mm-hmm. our children. And I remember her helping Kate with French. We didn't even mention French here, but Joanna occasionally taught French. And I remember her sitting in our living room, you know, working with Kate when Kate was a beginning French student. And Kate is now a translator in France. So that's another one of Joanna's contributions, I guess. And the talent show that you mentioned, I remember Kate playing a violin. And yeah, I'd forgotten about that one. Yeah, she was definitely, and Teresa mentioned this too, how she was such a grandmother figure to her children. Yeah. So
she had a gift, you know, to connecting with children. That was a gift. Not all adults are able to form a meaningful relationship in young people's lives.
The projects that Joanna was most proud of in the years before she left Ames were those that honored the Martin family, the Black family that maintained a boarding house for Black male students in the early years of the 20th century. The only one of the surviving members of that committee I could reach was Pauline Martin, but unfortunately I was unable to interview her for this program. Thanks to the Ames History Center, I do have a description of the Martin family, the house they built, the new dormitory that is dedicated in their honor at ISU, and the brick piers in downtown Ames. I'll play a discussion from Alex Vafer and Greta Anderson telling about the Martin House and the work of the committee.
Yeah, the Martins, so they're one of our earliest African-American families to live in Ames. They were both born into slavery just a few years prior to the start of the Civil War. And
so they weren't born in Iowa. They were from elsewhere.
Yeah. Archie was born in North Carolina, and Nancy was born in Georgia. And it sounds like they both they were living together in Georgia, married in the early 1900s. And kind of local lore is that a local husband and wife, they were both doctors, Dr. David and Dr. Jeannie Greist. They were touring the South on a little vacation, and they stopped at a local place to eat, and Nancy was actually cooking there. So they decided that they would invite Nancy to come be their personal cook in Ames. And so she came up and did that, and she also cooked for a fraternity house on campus. So the Greists are kind of the reason that she decided to come up this far north.
Okay. And they had quite a brood of children as well.
Yeah, I think they had, let's see, they had six children, I believe. Pretty large family. And then if you get some other people that are boarding with them through a time, I'm sure that house got very, very, very busy.
So they moved up to Ames, they brought their children, and they built this house themselves, I think.
Yes, they did, yeah. So the house is at 218 Lincoln Way, and if you're not familiar with exactly where that is, it's roughly across the street from Burger King on Lincoln Way, near the Duff Corner-ish, that
okay.
area. But yeah, they started building the house in 1919. It's a Craftsman-style bungalow. And something we need to remember at this point in 1919... the Lincoln Highway was just getting started. So that was adapted in 1913, 1914. They didn't even pave the road in that section until around 1917, I believe. So this is just it's not what we think of Lincoln Way today at all. But it's still the thoroughfare through town. We need to remember that.
So tell me about how it came that they started a boarding house for African-American students.
Well, I think they realized how tough it was. For them, because the rules at Iowa State were a little bit different back then. They were saying that African Americans were entirely welcome at the institution, but
of course there was George Washington
Carver
before them.
Yeah, George Washington Carver. Yeah, that was in the 1890s. So that's that's 15, almost 25 years before the Martins come to town. And then it was pretty much they were allowed to go and study, but they were only allowed to live on campus if they had enough to accommodate like a full floor or a full dorm. That was pretty much the rules, which was pretty much impossible with those numbers. I think up until...
So it was a segregated situation.
Very, very segregated. And they kind of made it so it was legal that they could, but it was so tough that they couldn't.
Huh.
Kind of one of those things.
Well, and a lot of students at that time weren't living in dorms. They were living in the community, in people's homes, right?
Yeah. Prior to, after 1900, when Old Main burned down, that was our one building, our first building where people, they live, they eat, they study, they do everything in there, teachers and students. So after that burns down, there's kind of a struggle for housing on campus, especially. So people are living in houses and clubs on Lincoln. Lincoln Way was lined with boarding houses, too. That's another business district that was nothing but homes. So people found their way into those or other fraternities and places.
So African Americans who came to Iowa State could find a place to live at the Martin Family House, that very building that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and it sounds like they really wanted to make sure that these students succeeded, and they kept them on track, it sounds like. One of the granddaughters, Pauline Martin, maybe some of you are familiar with her, she said that Nancy wouldn't put up with any nonsense.
Okay. She's a good cook, and she's a strict disciplinarian.
Yes, for sure.
And I heard that they had a piano in the house and that the students would sometimes play.
Yes, yeah. They incorporated that into the new dormitory. So that's another thing. We have a few ways besides the Martin House that the Martins are remembered. The Martin Hall on ISU campus, which was dedicated in 2008, I believe. They actually did. They put a piano in the like commons room because they knew music was such an important thing at the Martin House. They wanted to bring that into there.
Oh, that's right. There was a new dorm built on campus and named after the Martins.
Yeah, it's kind of in the Friley area, kind of tucked in there. I believe they're like suites, so they have like, you know, bedrooms and a little bathroom and a living room. But yeah, so that was in 2008 that opened for the first time, and that was also the same year that it was put on the historic landmark it was made a historic landmark by the Ames Historic Preservation Commission.
The house was, yes. Yeah. And then there's also one of those, what do you call those, brick pillars?
The brick piers. Yeah, or like Fifth Street Walking Tour. Yeah, they are also included on there. They actually have one for themselves, Archie and Nancy, and then there is one for the house.
There's two.
I think it's on the same pier, if I remember right.
Okay.
I think it's
that makes sense.
Near Burnett, but don't quote me. We have a map. Come down and check it out.
So, and all of that was done by, and that this whole effort to recognize the Martin family kind of came about through some volunteers, not necessarily members of the Martin family. As I know that Janet Kloss of the Ames, she was then of the Ames Library and the archives there. She was very involved in it. And Joanna Courteau.
Yeah.
All part of a group that thought it was important to recognize this family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then them combined with the Historic Preservation District. And then there's also a foundation set up by the Martin family. And that is actually what the I was in, so... Yeah, it's great to still have that house there. It's a lovely thing to pass by, and it kind of reminds you of what Lincoln Way looked like back then.
I'd like to close out this tribute to Joanna Courteau by referring you to her own words. One of Joanna's talents that she discovered when she moved to Ann Arbor was storytelling. NPR fans may know about Moth Radio, which is a collection of stories that come from a contest called Story Slams. They have these in Ann Arbor weekly, and I think that's where she discovered them. I couldn't download any of her stories, but if you go online and Google Storytelling Joanna Courteau, you'll get her story, Hermit No More, described as Joanna Courteau was an outsider by choice until a near-death experience cracks open her bashful shell. And I presume this is a true story, which, considering what you've heard today, is doubly amazing.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Your hosts for today have been Susan Franzen and Roberta Van. Other voices you heard were Gary Stahl,
Teresa Satterfeld, Micah Yankovic, Alex Pfeiffer,
and Greta Anderson. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, the Ames Public Library will present Reading Radio Live. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Capriccio Catalan by Isaac Albanez, played by David Russell. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. just hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.